Full Service Radio is proudly supported and hosted by Simplecast, the easiest way for a podcast creator to publish and distribute audio on the internet. For more information, visit Simplecast.com.
Hey friends, welcome to Shift Drink on Full Service Radio, broadcasting live from the Lion Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. I'm Matthew Ramsey, Wile E. Coyote, Cheeseburger Life Coach, and Late Night Cold Beer Crooner.
I'm Eddie Kim, proud DCist, sneaky barman, and highball evangelist. Every week, we share a shift drink and swap war stories from behind the line with chefs, bartenders, bakers, brewers, and anyone who touches this all-encompassing industry. I just want to say, before we go any further, that this is our last episode...
Of the season.
Dramatic pause.
So our last episode didn't really pan out too well for us. People still think we stopped, like...
Right, people still thought I was going to move to... Minnesota.
This is last April Fool's.
Felicia, I'm pretty sure you thought I was... I think you approached me one time and said, why didn't you move?
Yeah, I was like, goodbye party.
So this is just the last episode of this season. We'll be back in January. But back to the present. We have a very special guest in the studio today.
Yeah, this week we welcome our very own Felicia Colbert. Rising Star Chef Sommelier in 2018 and wine director at A Rake's Progress, conveniently right above our heads in the Line Hotel. Welcome.
It's like your downstairs neighbors never invite you to come over, and then finally they're like, oh yeah, we've been having this party downstairs that you hear every week. Do you want to
come? You can come by any time.
Let's be honest, the way the acoustics of the hotel lobby works, we hear everything that goes on upstairs. So it's the party upstairs, and then we're downstairs being like, what the hell is going on
up
there?
Yeah, missed out. Snooze, you lose.
Were you there when a certain Mr. Murray was dining?
I'm always here.
God damn it.
Yeah, that's a legendary.
Yeah. NPH was really story. The best, but whatever.
Jack gave us the text the following day, and not the... As it was happening, as
see?
He should have.
Well, now you know who your friend should be.
That's
Jack's
right.
Your second friend. No text and no wine.
But who did you just say was the better Murray or better than Murray?
Oh, I said NPH. Everybody knows.
Neil Patrick Harris.
Oh, yeah.
Did he whip out some magic?
He didn't, but one of my friends who was down the street actually belongs to the same magic castle in L.A.
Oh, yeah, the castle.
Yeah,
castle.
I didn't know that was a thing. Is it L.A.? I don't know where
it's
it
L.A.,
is.
Yes. Yeah, yeah, up okay. in the hills.
Yeah, magic castle, my friend Ross.
Invite only, I believe.
Yeah, he's really pumped about it.
That's awesome. Well, we are, I guess before we dig into it too deep here.
See what's going on.
Little weekend review. World.
Yeah. Well, speaking of LA, actually, LA Times, they just released their list of 101 best restaurants. They do it every year. This is the first one that they've released, I think, after, Jonathan Gold passed away. So we're actually very lucky that, one of our former guests, John Yao of Cato, won number one.
Sweet. Hot dogs.
Yeah. And then Maylin of Nightshade is on the list. And Konbi, Akira, Nick, and Jen are all on the list too. Sweet. So we've had some LA royalty in the house.
Yeah.
And
really
we're just glad
cool
to hear
really exciting.
A lot of people getting recognition out there. Mm-hmm. It's an exciting list.
I'm always excited when like people you know are like mm-hmm. nominated. You're like, somehow I'm famous too. I know them.
Yeah,
I ate there. I tasted that.
It's
we talked.
Well, not necessarily new news. I guess at this point it's kind of older news, but we're in another Malort drought, essentially.
There's no Malort?
Not anymore. Yeah. They've turned off the tap for what? DC, and
we had a discussion. We're trying to figure out exactly what happened, if the distributor is dropping the ball or if the manufacturers aren't shipping it to DC anymore.
Well, it seems to be the case, is that they've decided that DC is not a market for them.
What? Not even with Ivy and Coney?
Well, I think their reach even extended past Ivy and Coney at this point, but Ivy and Coney received their last case, I think, last week, so it's probably already gone.
Wow. So what are we going to do? What's going to be the new...
I mean, Chicago's not that far of a drive. It would not be hard to get a van.
I think it's times like these that we see people's true merits and grit.
Road trip?
Yeah, I think some fun things will happen out of this. They're even talking... Ivy and Cody's even talking about making their own Malort-style...
What goes into Malort?
It's just a Maro that is, I think, burnt, unbalanced and
burnt
kind
tires.
Of gross.
Yeah, like skunks, trash. Are we allowed to drink this wine?
Yes, absolutely. Yes. I'm very happy about this wine, by the way. So this is a shift drink, and you are a wine director upstairs, and usually Eddie and I bring the beverages, but you're treating us.
Yes, treat yourself.
What do we have here?
So this is one of my favorite, I don't know. So I've started to use the phrase natural wine, which was something I tried to stay away from, maybe the first, year and a half that we were open, just because, like natural food, it doesn't have a legal definition.
Right.
Now, just because it doesn't have a legal definition doesn't mean that it's not a signifier for a style of growing or winemaking that people aren't doing. And so it's not to say that natural wine isn't a thing. It definitely is a thing. But what is it exactly is kind of hard to put your finger on, because most people are growing their grapes organically or biodynamically, which is kind of... organics plus, you know, some magic and moon cycles, definitely poop involved.
Yes.
They're generally not inoculating, right? So they're not adding yeast the same way you would buy like yeast to make bread at a store.
Natural fermentation.
Right. There are yeasts that kind of exist in the environment. And so people are just letting those natural fermentations happen, which sometimes if you're in a warm environment, right, will happen rather quickly because yeast eats sugar and they're already like, yes, they're so much sugar around. But sometimes if you have environments that the yeast aren't as active, it might take a week or 2 weeks, sometimes 3 weeks, sometimes 4 weeks. And so you can imagine as your fruit is sitting around for upwards of a month, what can kind of happen. We've all let fruit sit on our counter for, you know, 3 days too long, and we know what starts to happen. So you can imagine, right, in those environments that winemakers have to be very careful to keep things pretty temperature controlled. And if they're not, you do get some additional flavors and textures that sometimes get into wine. And then after the alcoholic fermentation happens, those wines are then generally not fined or filtered. Imagine, right, a cheesecloth or maybe a nut bag. Right. Pushing your liquid through something that is capturing a lot of particulates, but also maybe flavors and textures. And so generally, right, natural wine will be made from grapes that are grown organically or biodynamically with not inoculated yeast, and the wine is not fine or filtered. Now, sulfur, we won't even talk about that, right? Because people, you know, we just won't. Just an asterisk, sulfur is naturally occurring as a part of the winemaking process, right. And no
dried
wine can
fruits,
actually
French fries.
Happen without it. But for people who are allergic to sulfur, I'm sure you're also allergic to air and happiness. So,
and MSG.
That's a thing. Yeah. You know, it's to each his own. But yeah, so, you know, saying that, like, this wine sits in that natural camp, I would definitely say yes. Huda Ambrose and her daughter are essentially foraging bush grapes. So grapes will grow naturally, and as they kind of spread out, they'll take over trees and things, and you'll have red grapes and white grapes kind of just grown together, which is pretty much when people are kind of making like home wine, that's what you get, is small vineyards that have grapes that are co-planted together. Her and her daughter are then co-fermenting those grapes, right? They're taking the grapes red and white, they're letting them go from just being grapes and grape juice to being grape skins and alcohol, i.e. wine. And then they're not fining or filtering it. And so you have this red wine that kind of tastes like a red wine, but it also kind of tastes like a white wine. It's really light and crunchy and minerally. This is coming from Vienna, which actually has more vines planted per person than any place else in the world. Fun fact, we call those a Daniel fact where I come from. And so it's just like a super easy to drink, just like crushed town wine.
I have a natural appreciation for this wine. Now, the bottle says Raquette, but there's probably a better
pronunciation. Yeah, I think a German person, R-A-K-E-T-E, would help us out with that pronunciation.
Raquette.
Yeah, I think it's like there's like a hard no, it's E or
super
T.
Crushable. The label art, obviously, I mean, never judge a book by its cover, but this cover's cool.
It's pretty cool, yeah. Like that diagonal, just plain black and white, almost comic book style.
I've always been a fan of the, I guess the style of bottle is a Riesling bottle?
Yeah, Riesling, that Alsatian, that very skinny, long neck bottle. Like a long neck.
But generally, like, there are no rules. I mean, that's kind of what natural wine is all about.
Right. There's no rules. And so when you start to talk about places in the world where there are a lot of rules, I don't think that having rules or not having rules is good or bad, right? I think that people should understand natural wine kind of on that same spectrum as regular wine. And so there are really luxurious, really like fancy styles of natural wine coming from people who have expensive land or are using expensive products or just making something that is a rarity, right? And, you know, you also have just like everyday drinking, easy to come by wines.
But there's like a fine line between natural wines and our more traditional, straightforward wines. And they're at loggerheads with each other of these two schools of thought on wine. And it's still happening to this day. And we have like Domestique, a wine shop here in D.C. that's kind of sort of trying to bridge the gap between the two.
I think they're doing a pretty good job. It's really just people understanding that there's a spectrum, right? And if you want wine that tastes like kombucha, you can get it, but it doesn't mean that the land was taken care of or the people were taken care of. It just means somebody let grape juice turn into wine and put it in a bottle, you know?
Yeah.
There are wines that taste natural, right? Or wines that taste as if they don't have a lot of intervention. And then there are wines that don't taste like that. I bought a second wine because less isn't more. More is more. And I kind of bought it just as kind of as we're talking about, right, that natural wine camp. Solis, Uncle Claude, Colberly, he's out in California. And when we talk about no intervention, right, when we talk about taking the most pristine, clean, unadulterated land, planting grapes, waiting, you know, almost two decades before you make wine from it, and putting forth grapes in sunshine, no person that I know of, you know, in their heart of hearts is more dedicated to that than Claude. And his wines speak to that. If anybody's ever had an opportunity to have any of the Solis Pinot Noirs or Chardonnays or Sauvignon Blancs or Syrahs, they know that, like, these wines, you close your eyes and they taste like ethereal, if that is even a flavor.
A taste of the ethereal. I don't. It's funny. I always like think of winemaking as like playing jazz because you're simultaneously creating and reacting to what's been given. Right. Nothing is there might be a framework for where you want things to go, but how you actually get there is based on your artisanship and your knowledge. And you get different styles, and people have come from different places. I think it's fascinating in that sense.
Yeah, with the understanding that wine is a seasonal agricultural product, and variation comes with it. If you're drinking a wine and it tastes the same every single year, you should ask yourself why. How is it possible that
I'm looking at you, smoking loon.
Right? I mean, and there's blending that can happen, right? There are house styles. There's an understanding that, like, if I open a bottle, you know, of big house champagne, I kind of want it to taste the same way. But if you don't have decades worth of backstock, how are you making this wine taste the same every single year?
Do we want it to taste the same?
You know? I'll argue the other point where there is a market for people who want consistency in their product.
They just
want
to know what they're getting.
I've been drinking the same Riesling, the first one I had in college, every year for the past like 15 plus years. The Dr. Lucin. Yeah. It's like, and it's easy to teach young college kids. This is a very good example of what a Riesling will taste like.
100%.
And just like add a nostalgia. I buy a bottle every year.
But also, that entry level Dr. Lucin is coming from a blend, mm-hmm. right, of grapes and parcels, because there's no way that you can make that wine taste the same every single year without blending something. And that's why we have different varieties, different clones of the same grape, mm-hmm. right? Or people who do, right, age in Solera systems or believe in kind of non-vintage labeling. And I think that with kind of natural wine there, that movement of people being a little bit more accepting of kind of this gray area, I think is great. But also, I always like to asterisk people, like, bad wine is bad wine. And like, sometimes people just make something that's yeah. gross and they try to tell you that it's cool.
Like, well, I mean, look at PBR or any other like cheap beer. I mean, like, but there's a time and a place, right? Like, I will drink boxed wine.
I'm not talking about boxed wine. I'm talking about wine where somebody made it wrong.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, I mean, like, where on the spectrum? Let's draw a line in the sand. Where in the spectrum do you say it's wrong?
And so that also comes with like right? There's like a lot of pushback. So I'm a court somm. The Court of Master Sommeliers classifies a very long list, or, you know, concise list of things that are considered, right, wine flaws. In that include, right, levels of Brettanomyces, right, volatile acidity, right? But the thing about it is, right, you know, people will say that too much volatile acidity or VA is a bad thing, but then also, you know, people will enjoy things like Barolo and Brunello, which always include VA, and it's added as, right, a layer of complexity, a tertiary note to that. Now, Brettanomyces, right, is bacteria. A little bit of it, right? Some people say adds another layer of savoriness to wine. Too much, and, you know, the wine tastes like poop. But, like, what is too much? Mm-hmm. That is very arbitrary. And so, for me, I don't know. I think things like mousiness. Mm-hmm. I don't think mousiness is something that is enjoyable. I don't, in small quantities, mousiness on the nose can sometimes blow off and not be on the palate. But for me, right, when a wine tastes like, and by mousiness, we're talking about that kind of corn chip Frito-Lays.
Hamster.
Cage, that, old kombucha.
It's a hot topic. We've talked about it several times, but also some people don't believe it actually exists.
Yeah.
Because like the like ability global to warming. Actually, so, taste it is not.
I'll be honest, like, I wasn't sure it existed.
Yeah.
Until recently, where I did have a bottle of wine, left it open for a little bit, and then the mousiness came out. So I'm like, now, okay, I understand. It does, it's there.
Right. And it's something that oxidation definitely mm-hmm. enhances. And so there are wines that I serve upstairs that I tell people they exist in a very special window, right? I don't want to decant this wine. I want this wine to have as little oxygen as possible. I want you to enjoy it, because if you let this wine sit out for 3 hours, maybe even an hour and a half, it's going to start tasting like a flavor that you don't really enjoy.
Interesting.
But for some people, I guess that may be enjoyable. I don't know. I guess as the wine professional, that is, you know, for me to decide for my guest. And if you're a guest and you dine at a Rake's Progress and I open a bottle of wine and there's mouse all over it, well, I'm not going to serve it to you. And, you know, I might be wrong, and that might be something that I have to like rectify at another time. But that particular flavor is not one that I enjoy. And we pour a lot of natural wines. I think that people have yet to find out that I'm probably running the most dynamic natural wine program in the city, just under the guise of, you know, right, a little bit of elevated dining. And so, yeah, you can come here and get like wines that I have to go out in the world and twerk for. You know what I mean? Like even this Riquette, this comes from Bowler. This is an importer out of New York. And so I have to be very, very, very nice. To a
that's
number
a very
of
special
people,
bottle. Thank
yeah,
you.
To get it, and that's okay. That's okay for me, because DC is the Wild West. We can get anything that we want.
Which is we've talked. talked about that also in previous episodes, where we're able to bring in things that other places don't get to experience just because of our way we're set up.
So I always tell people, if you're looking to sell your wine, if you don't have any representation, I'm here. I'll buy it. I got dollars.
I mean, in your wine, as like personally in your wine career, how has been working in DC specifically versus other cities? Has it been advantageous? Been very unique?
I mean, I think that it is every single thing about my career is where I am. I think DC, I mean, people might push back against this, but I think that they should probably do a little bit of self-reflection, is a very inclusive wine city. If you're a court somm like I am, we taste with WSET somms. We invite them to our group. We have a lot of crossover between brand side and somm side. We try to be as inclusive as we can because we understand that when you don't have laws that govern the way that you have to act and sell wine, that the best way for you to get the best wine is just to be nice, right? To be nice and to be welcoming and to include as many people as you can. And so I can definitely say, as a brown woman in this world, that there are a lot of places that I won't live and won't move to. And it has very much been a determining factor when I think about relocating or, you know, what places that I could move to, the inclusivity of my wine community. The fact that we have master sommeliers that will come and taste with you if you want to, right? Jared is at RDV, and there's not a person around that will tell you that they asked him to taste and he was like, I don't have time, I'm not available. You know what I mean? Like, we have regular tasting groups that meet, you know what I mean? Like, Ellie, the mother of all somms in DC, has been, you know, hosting a certified tasting group for, I don't know, 10 years now, almost. Like, I know people have gone to other places and other wine communities in this country, you know, not too far from here, and they've said that you can't find that community. And so the community alone is worth it. And then that paired with the fact that there isn't a wine that is available in this world that we can't purchase in this area.
Fuck yeah.
Yeah.
Now, we were reading earlier, and I know you were going for your master's somm certificate. It's
still on the path.
Yeah.
Still on the path. Yeah. I mean, you're essentially a third degree black belt in wine, right?
I feel like I know nothing about wine. Like, there's so much to know.
what is the training and the path that will take you from where you already are, which is extremely advanced, to that grandmaster dragon level of master somm, which only, what, 249 people have currently?
Yeah. I mean, I definitely think that it's time, right? What I, you know, took away every year, right? Basically, you're either testing or you're applying to test, basically, on your kind of master somm path. And I always tell people, like, being a court somm is for someone who wants to be a master sommelier. There's no reason to go down that path, to spend that much time and energy in doing it.
And money.
And money, right? And doing it if you don't plan on going the whole way through. And so the goal at every level of your examination should always be master's. If you're intro, it should be master's. If you're certified, it should be master's, advanced master's. Because if you're always studying for that test, then you're not like, well, how much knowledge do I need? Everything. You need to know everything. Like, as close to everything as you can get. Or it's not even everything. I remember a question I missed on my last exam was, what is the maximum yield in liters per hectoliter for Grand Cru Alsace? For most people, that seems arbitrary, right? It seems like a very arbitrary question, but in actuality, right? Alsace, right? We're talking about this desert region in France, used to make really shit wine. And so what the government did was they said, we're going to have some of the strictest wine laws in all of the world. And so they're asking you, out of a region that went from almost no wine laws to the strictest wine laws, what is the requirement for the highest level of classification there? You should know that, right? If you want to be an expert in your field, you should know that. And it's not an arbitrary question. And so, you know, people are always like, yeah, well, it's not fair. It's this, it's that, it's whatever. You know, I passed service and I passed tasting because I was ready. I do them regularly.
Yeah.
Right? I didn't pass theory because instead of studying, you know, until I didn't go to sleep, I went to sleep.
Yeah.
Because, you know, that's how it goes.
In my mind, I'm cueing this, like, wushu training montage with remote mountains, like, bamboo, so, spit cups and blindfolds.
Yes.
Just to make sure everyone's on the same line. Okay, so Quartermasters is one of the certifications out there, probably the most popular one.
Yes.
It's what's featured in SOM documentary.
Yeah.
There are four levels. Matthew, we had to look this up earlier. So there's intro.
Yep.
There's certified SOM.
Yep.
There's advanced SOM.
Yep.
And then there's the big MS,
yep.
Master SOM. MS was the one that those guys were going for in the doc.
In the documentary. And so yep. You also have the other kind of organization, WSET.
WSET, yep.
Yep, WSET, which I also feel like is very pertinent because people are like, oh, well, I want to be a court SOM. And I'm like, oh, do you want to work in a restaurant, you know, nights and weekends and holidays and never see your family forever? Mm-hmm. And people are like, oh, no, I don't want to do that. And I'm like, then you should do WSET. Because otherwise, right, WSET has essentially those same levels, but instead of your job being your teacher, you have a proctor as your teacher, and you have a community of people that sit in a classroom setting with you, and your focus is more on sales and wine as a market kind of commodity as opposed to service and the physical aspects of, like, putting down something on the right side, using a guéridon, right? Using serviettes, understanding what tray service is. And so if you're not going to work in a restaurant, it is a waste of your time, money, and energy to go along that path when you're going to essentially be isolated. Because I get to taste $1 million worth of wine a year because I'm a buyer, you know?
Right.
And you're in a unique position. So we were looking back at old shows. You were the first actual working SOM on the floor that we have. We've had wine people, we've had experts, and they've all worked in restaurants at some point. But right now, you are actually working on the floor and doing your MS. And so that puts you in a unique... I mean, do you feel yourself, like, have a unique perspective on that world of wine?
When I first found out what a sommelier was, I didn't really understand what that meant because I worked with two master sommeliers and an advanced sommelier that worked the floor. So I didn't know that sommeliers didn't work the floor. I didn't know that, like, most master sommeliers were like, peace out. That's the first thing that you do is you quit that restaurant job. And so I only knew that for a number of years. And then when I found out that, no, there's so many SOMs that do other things. They don't work the floor. I was kind of shocked because my most favorite thing about what I do is service. I love service. That's why I do wine. It's not vice versa. And so the elevation of hospitality that you can give people when you're the wine person is, it has no bounds, right? Like, I can pull literally time capsules from somewhere and share that with someone. And so, I think it's pretty unique, but also, like, really challenging because when it comes to, right, like, time, you know, it's hard to do that when you work in a restaurant, especially one in a hotel where, you know, we're open all the time, you know, mm-hmm. And how do you balance
the hotel life?
Yeah. Studying and running a wine program for a restaurant, simultaneously running a wine program for a hotel and brides and trying to study and memorize, you know, the liters and hectoliter per gram per Alsace, you know, it's like had all of those things happen. And I think it just, it's for a very specific person. Yeah. And you have to find out if you're that person while you're doing it.
Well, I think we're going to take a quick step out for a second. We're going to cut to a little break. You're listening to Shift Drink. We have Felicia from Rick's Progress, Matthew Ramsey.
I'm Eddie Kim.
And we'll be right back.
We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Shift Drink. We're talking on Full Service Radio in the Line Hotel. Right now, lounging like Baby Yoda on her chair.
Baby Yoda, nice.
You came in very, very bundled up.
I did.
It's definitely Yoda vibes. We have Felicia, head som, or actually wine director at A Rake's Progress upstairs in the hotel.
Woo woo.
Now, Felicia, to understand wine at your level, this goes beyond simply knowing and identifying an infinite number of grape varietals. You also have to have a rich understanding of the people and kind of the vastly different cultures that actually produce the wine. Now, you got a degree in sociology, which I think is kind of interesting.
We're creeping.
I'm like, stalk me later. All right. Yeah, I did.
We do our research around
it's
these parts.
It's good. It was so helpful.
Yeah. I mean, do you see your work in wine as almost an extension of your background in sociology?
1 bajillion percent. Yeah. Like, for sure. I told my, I guess, fiancé now.
Oh, congratulations.
Husband, yes.
Breaking news.
Yes, breaking news, Scoop. Breaking news. I told him that I wanted to go back to school soon and, you know, get my PhD. And he was like, yeah, you know, whatever makes you happy, because he's smart. And, you know, I told him I was going to continue my degree in sociology just because my education was so rich. I went to University of Maryland, and the faculty there, they actually have one of the top sociology programs, top 10 in the country. And the faculty, when someone's been teaching a class for longer than you've been alive, and you're like, you know, 30 and in college still, it's like, yeah, that's the kind of person that I want to learn from. And the education I got there was just so impactful, especially just a class I took on social psychology and just understanding how people interact
This is literally a study on society,
yes.
social interaction and the culture of everyday life. And like, what is more perfect than diving down that wine rabbit hole where you get to interact with guests in that
Which is like a crosshair of like socioeconomics and gender and like just so many things that you have to navigate that when you approach someone and you're like, hi, I'm here to either bring you something that you didn't know about or ask you to spend more money than you planned on spending. There's definitely a very tight rope that I walk, especially just given, you know, who I am, being a brown lady som, of which there are quite few of. People are rectifying their cognitive dissonance in real time as I watch, to say the least.
I mean, actually, I'm glad you brought that up. We talked about this past summer because there was the talk featuring Domestique and Full Service Radio at the DC Public Library. We brought in a bunch of food and beverage professionals with a wine-focused discussion. And I think at one point there was almost like a general agreement that the certifications aren't needed, especially with the wide world of natural wines coming in, and people can basically kind of carve their own niche. But I think you disagreed.
100%. I definitely think that, you know, when people say, oh, you don't need a certification, well, one, they're probably coming from a place of privilege. You oftentimes, I mean, most people, when I walk around the restaurant, they don't think that I'm the wine director, right? They think I'm the hostess. And oftentimes, when I come to people's tables and they ask for the sommelier and I drop a wine list off and I ask them if they have any questions, still when I approach their table again and I'm like, hi, do you have any questions? They're like, oh, I thought you were, I think the last time I approached someone when this happened, they said, oh, you seemed managerial. I'm like, what does that even mean?
Do you wear the pin?
Always. I wear my pen, unless I forget, I wear my pen every shift. Just because, right? I also come from, you know, luxury wine sales. And I think that most people, when you're going to ask someone to give you $5,000 or $10,000 in literal liquid assets, they'd like to know that your opinion is substantiated, right? I'm not telling you that this wine is good because my name is Felicia and I like wine, right? There are lots of people who come and dine here, and they are very opinionated, and sometimes they're well drank than me because they have the means to do so. But, you know, there is an organization that certifies sommeliers that allows me to tell you that, sir, you might be trying to flex in front of all your friends, but I assure you that this bottle isn't corked. And if you want your Chardonnay served at 25 degrees, well, I'm happy to bring it down to that temperature, but that's not the appropriate temperature to serve that wine at. And there's nothing wrong with me or the way that I'm running my program. It is your preference. You can prefer anything that you'd like, and we're happy to accommodate that, but there is a way that wine service is done and hospitality is done throughout the world, and those are global standards, of which I did not set that standard. So if you want to know what governs, right, what sets the bar for how we do wine service here at A Rake's Progress, then those standards have been set by the Court of Master Sommeliers. And if you have a problem with how we do service here, then that's okay, but you have a problem with an entire organization, not an individual.
I mean, do you have any ambitions to... I mean, a lot of the older organizations do have issues with inclusivity and diversity. Do you have any ambitions to help change that from within?
I mean, I think my very presence changes that, right? Like, when I go to exams, when I sit at tasting group, my very presence as a member of that organization forces that organization to decide some things, right? To decide how inclusive they're going to be. And I'm also not a cog, right? I'm not a person who's going to sit here and say, oh, hey, you know, this is okay, or this is not right, or not. I'm the squeaky wheel, right? And so if I'm there, anyone who knows me, right?
Yep.
I'm here to stand up for what's right, no matter what, you know? And so if that means that I'm here to call, you know, the organization that I'm a member of to a higher level of accountability, well, you have to absolutely know when I sat for my exam and I had the ear of many master sommeliers, what I had to say was, what are we doing about the inclusivity, right? What are we doing about making this a thing that people can actually do? Because I've had a lot of privilege in my life that's led me to this point, but other people, they don't have that same privilege. And so what are we doing about that? Right.
I mean, are there any words of advice for anyone who would want to start, who is not part of the majority that would want to start carving their way through this industry?
Yeah, I would say one, where you live matters. And I know that people don't want to hear that, but there's a reason that I don't live in Louisiana or Alabama. And like, racism is a very real thing. And so if you think that the same opportunities are going to be easy for you if you're living in areas with very oppressive and overt racism, then you should probably move, right? Like, I'm just being very real. After that, right, if you do find yourselves in those areas and you don't want to move, then you have to be the person who's going to be the change maker, which is a constant effort that you can't get tired of. So if you're a person who's going to grow tired of always having to be the person who's fighting, being the squeaky wheel, then like, move to a place where it's easier for you, right? And if you choose not to do that, then know that there are people, right? The internet is a magical place. It's a deep, dark, scary place, but the internet is a magical place. And there are people out there that will hear you and will find you. You just have to make yourself known. And sometimes it's hard to be that person who's like, hey, I'm the only one, right? Because you do make yourself a target. But also, like, you're either going to go to a place where it's easier for you to incite change, right, from the inside, or you're going to be the person on the outside who's like, we're going to do this. And so there are areas that are inclusive. I tell people, if you want to come to DC, yes, come here. We are open and this is a place that you can go. But you have to create a community, right? Because there is no way that I would be here or do any of the things that I'm doing without my community, honestly, like, period. And that's why I'm tied to it, because there are just too many wines that you need to drink. There are too many places in the world that you need to go to and see and not just read about in books. And if you don't create a community, you're not going to be able to do it unless you're so wealthy. And also, just, it's okay to be the person who says that's wrong. Like, be okay with that. I know it's a very uncomfortable place to be in, but like, what's wrong is wrong and what's right is right. And if you can't get a job, or if you're fired, or if you're whatever, for standing up for the right thing, like, then you need to make some decisions, right? Where you either have to change where you are, or you have to just continue to push. Because, like, I think people have this idea that, like, America is going to stop being racist, or we're going to be more inclusive because of, like, these big movements and things that are going to happen. No, it's people holding their friends accountable, right? It's the small accountabilities that then, right, lead to this greater change. You know, we have a DC food critic who thinks it's okay to be overtly racist. And I brought it to the attention of a lot of people in this city. And do you know what they had to say? What are we going to do against someone who has a million person readership? So you're telling me that you're unwilling to do something because doing the right thing might make you look bad? Okay.
I mean, it's got to start somewhere, you know. On a more personal level, I know, and we've talked about this previously. Eddie, your parents, I don't think, really understand what it is you do. I know my parents. I mean, they get it on some level, but it's like, unless you've worked in the hospitality trenches, you don't fully understand kind of what compels us to do what we do, which is.
A professional wine taster, I think.
Yeah. I mean, does your family, do your loved ones understand your choice in careers and what you're doing right now?
So last month was the first month that, and probably the last 6 years, that my mother didn't send me a listing for a real job. And my mother is retired Army officer. She has 3 masters and 2 PhDs, and she has a very specific way that she sees success. And when I told her, you know, I was not going to my law school and I was breaking up with my boyfriend and I was moving into my best friend's bedroom because I was going to be a SOM, she was like, "What are you doing with your life?" But I had the opportunity when I sat for my last exam, my mother came with me to St. Louis, and she got to see.
Oh, wow.
She got to see. And it was only then when she was able to kind of see the rigor, to see the community, to meet master sommeliers, to talk to them, that she really understood. I mean, my mom, I've worked at, you know, 2 Michelin star restaurants. You know, like, my mom has never cared how fancy the place that I looked at, you know, worked at looked. You know, it was only then that she kind of understood that.
Saw you in your element doing your thing.
Yeah, and it's not just about drinking wine, you know? Right. Like, we're not just hanging out and getting drunk. Actually, the worst part about this job is that most of the wine we have to spit out. We don't even get to drink it. But to understand that there's more of an academic aspect, a lifelong learning aspect to it, that you have to take all of these other things into account. It's not just getting trashed.
For the record, though, we're definitely not spitting right now.
Definitely not spitting.
We're being very temperate. We actually haven't even gone through the first bottle yet. Quickly, was it more stress? Was it more stressful or more comforting to have your mother there?
I think it was more comforting. Yeah. Like, but I think it depends on your mother. You know, like, I have a very intense mother. We are ethnic people. My mother is Latina. So I talk to my mother every day, sometimes multiple times a day. And she is my biggest fan, but also my biggest critic. And so, you know, like, I'm my mother's child. She's the most exceptional person I know. And to have her there, you know, was its amount of stressful. But when I didn't pass, you know, to have my mother there to comfort me was, I mean... When you're crying in public, you want your mom there, right?
Very much so. Very much so.
It's more often that people don't pass, actually, right?
Yeah.
For MS, yes.
I think there are more people who have gone into outer space than there are people who have passed their advanced exam, I think was the statistic I heard the last
Especially
time.
On the first try, too.
Yeah. So, you know, but, like, there are people who do pass, and I think that there is something to be said about the people that do pass. And if you are a person that did pass, you understand what had to go into that. I didn't pass, but what I got instead was a wine program. I put my wine program, running a wine program, my first wine program, building my own list, my own legacy, we'll have it, right? I put that before staying up for 17 hours and spending 2 more hours when I got home studying. And like at the time, I was really upset that I did it, but you know, when I look back on it, I came home to my wine program.
Yeah.
I came home to a restaurant full of people that were like, it doesn't matter if you pass or failed. It matters the fact that like you are the person who continues to lead us forward in wine knowledge.
Well, it's a process of finding your voice, but also, I mean, I was thinking about this earlier, like there's no other, I don't think there's any other consumer facing topic where people dive so deeply into and require such mastery and knowledge. Like, I don't know anything else about any, I mean, that's not fair, but like
a doctor,
the stuff, but I mean, but consumer facing, like right, as far yeah. as like,
well, I can make an argument that doctors are consumer facing, yeah. and we forget that sometimes, and we put them on a pedestal. Like, this is the reason why I'm not a doctor. I'm about to go through a rabbit hole. Like,
let's talk.
Issues are coming up.
Let's talk. I mean, like, there's just nothing with such breadth of like reverence and like. I mean, there's.
Well, isn't that like a construct that is created by wine professionals, by the courtesans?
I think it's a construct that's created by Americans. And this is why, because in the rest of the world, wine is seen as a grocery item, right? Yeah. And like you go to the grocery store and maybe you need to ask a butcher about your hamburger meat, but generally you know what you're getting, right? The rest of the world, I think, sees sommeliers as what they are, an expert in their field if you need expertise advice, right? And the time that you need an expertise advice is when you are about to make a large purchase. You know, a sommelier at like a restaurant at a diner doesn't make sense because I hope you're not making an expertise decision when you're eating at a diner. But when you're about to spend, right, you know, a fifth, an eighth, whatever, like even if it's a hundredth of your income, but the bottle of wine is $25,000, wouldn't you want someone who says, hey, somebody else has decided that I have the knowledge to tell you about this?
But like, I mean, even like a butcher or I mean, there's just no one else is getting tested and certified in such a way.
A kosher butcher, maybe.
The consumer needs to.
I thought about going into kosher butchery. I'm just letting you know.
And I respect that. But no, I think it's incredible that like such. Yeah. Yeah, it's wild.
And also, I think that people forget it's like there's so much to know about wine. And the best part about being a somm isn't a pen or a test. It's the fact that like at 2:30, I have to sit down to drink wine. I have to. Like that's because I have an appointment and that's what I have to do. And then someone gives me tens of thousands of dollars of their money to just buy wine. That's the best part about this job, right? Is the fact that like I went to Champagne last week and Quentin Paillard put his kids to bed and said, I'll come take you out for a drink. Right?
It's
like,
yeah.
It's not that I get to wear a pen or, you know, be one of a handful of people. It's the best part about the life of a sommelier is the life.
Yeah. Jeez, I was here going to break down some of the glamorous aspects of working in the restaurant. Just you make it sound like it's freaking.
No, most of the time.
Rock stars.
Most of the time, it's inventory and dealing with racist people.
Exactly.
Like, that's what it is. Most of the time, it is, I am a server, a back waiter.
Or it's running outside your restaurant and stopping two people from stealing the tires off your bicycle.
So bike. This is a side note that I was telling Eddie about last night. I was in service. My bike was locked up outside. But I'd been late, so I didn't do the full lock thing.
Yeah, where you locked the wheels.
The wheels.
You did not say that it was your.
Well, but I also shouldn't have to. Like I beat myself up because these fuckers are taking my bike. But I look outside. I'm in the weeds. It's first turn, and I see two people crouched over my bike. And I just like my instincts kick off and I just bolt out the door during service and I'm just like,
yo.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm
this
yelling
is the front door because Tail Up Go has only one.
I'm I'm confronting these two like kids essentially. I'm just like, get the fuck away from my bike. And then all this shit goes down, and then I have to go back inside and pick up my tables again and be like, how are your scallops? Can I get you more water? And like, my adrenaline levels are through the roof, and I'm just like, on one side, like hulking out, and then on the other side, yes. I'm like, oh, are you enjoying your pasta?
That's the most difficult part of service, is that it is the antithesis of human nature. You have to put aside all of the things that say, I have to survive and put my own needs first. And you can't, because you have to put the needs of somebody else first.
And that's our calling.
That's our calling.
Well, we are starting to kind of get to that point in the hour where we should maybe move along to...
this cake?
Oh, yeah. Eddie did bring cake
for Felicia. I did run out the door and get some cake for Felicia.
We'll do a little cake. And also, two truths, one lie. Let's play a little game.
Two truths, one lie.
Alright, now Felicia, you are, it sounds like you're new to this game. You've never played this game before. We've asked that you lie to us once and tell us two truths, and Eddie and I will decide what is what.
Two truths, one lie. Alright. Since we're at work, I figured this would be work related. Two truths, one lie. So I'm going to tell you three places, three jobs that I used to have. Two of them are true.
Oh, okay. We've done a lot of research. Let's not forget sociology, I guess.
Two of them are true. One of them is a lie.
Hit us.
One. I used to work at Medieval Times.
Wow, I'm jealous. I'm so fucking jealous.
Two.
M'lady.
I used to work at the zoo.
Okay, zoo lights, very apropos.
Three. I used to work at a nursery.
That's a lie. That's the lie.
A plant nursery, I assume. Okay.
Oh, yeah, sure, a plant nursery, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know.
Oh. I was watching your face. I think that's a lie.
I was not looking at your face.
Okay, I think you guys have to do it separately. So two truths and a lie. Yeah, one of them is a lie and two of them are true. Yeah, go ahead.
Medieval Times. Okay, so I read that you used to work at an Outback Steakhouse. So I'm in my weird logic, I'm thinking that you could change that to a Medieval Times. So that might be the lie.
Because Outback and Medieval Times are the same place. Steaks and horses. Okay, cool.
G'day, mate. At 8 o'clock, we got the Falcon, whatever, I don't know. All that was horrible. But
Ye old bloomin' onion.
They do the Falcon thing. It's part of the show. It's the best part. We all know it, Medieval Times.
You think it's a plant thing, the nursery?
I was watching her face. No. Nursery. No, she was reaching.
Felicia's a crazy plant lady. That's definitely a possibility.
Why do I have to be crazy? Why can't I be a regular plant lady?
But it needs to be three words. It's like a term. It's like NPH, Neil Patrick Harris, crazy plant lady.
Whatever this cake is, I just want to let you know I'm into it.
It's a cake at the local bakery right around the corner, Kogi Bao.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, just there. They just have like random slices ready to go. Mm. If you're in Adams Morgan and you need a slice of cake.
The strawberry? Get the strawberry.
All right. The people need to know. Eddie Kim, what do you think is a lie?
Okay, we'll split it. I'm going to say that Medieval Times is a lie.
Okay, I am saying the nursery is a lie.
Yeah.
And the lie is the zoo.
Ah, God damn it.
Wow, we suck.
First of all, Medieval Times was the best job I ever had. I just want to let you know. I was a wench, and it was amazing. Good. I have so many good friends from when I worked at Medieval Times.
Is this the one in Maryland? Is there one
yes.
in Maryland?
Okay, Arundel Mills. Shout out to all my homies, Derek, Melissa, Daniel. Oh, geez, from the castle.
All avid listeners.
My sister was there, too. It was great.
I fucking love that Medieval Times. Actually, the last time I was there was I was on mushrooms. And then went gambling next door and won a lot of money.
Oh, my gosh. See? That's the win.
That's Medieval Times
yes.
for you.
Yes. And my first job was at a nursery for plants. It was the best. I loved it. It was in Central Florida. It was my mom's friend, and that's where I loved plants, and I am a plant
lady. And that's how you became such a CPL.
Yeah.
Crazy plant lady. If anyone loves me, I've NPL. Never been to a medieval time, so you can take me sometime for my birthday, even though.
Yeah. And lastly, a little game we call Rapid Fire.
Ding, ding, ding.
For the payback. Rapid fire.
So these are gonna be just quick questions, tip of the tongue responses, whatever comes to mind. Eddie Kim, hit it.
Ugh. Let's go down to the Proust questionnaire. What is your idea of perfect happiness?
Wow.
Eating, that's drinking, and traveling, and having somebody else pay for it.
That's good. Mm-hmm. Favorite Keanu Reeves movie?
What's the one when he shoots everybody?
All of them.
The Matrix.
No. The ones recently. There's Sweet like one. John Wick. John Wick.
Two.
John Wick. All the John Wicks.
Hey, by the way, John Wick. I'm just gonna say this out there. John Wick 4 and another number 4 movie.
Matrix 4.
Matrix 4 coming out at the same time.
Same day. It's officially Keanu Reeves Day. I'll be at the doubleheader.
I'm doing that too.
It's so far off though that I don't know if they're gonna still sync up when they get done. I mean, there's a lot can happen.
I don't care. It's like they announced it. It has to happen.
It has to happen.
So both of the movies, both starring Keanu Reeves, are gonna be out on the same day.
Either way, Keanu Reeves wins.
Felicia, if there were a wine that you would pair up with Keanu Reeves, what would it be?
Good question.
Oh man, if Keanu Reeves is the equivalent of baby Jesus in terms of movies, then the baby Jesus of wine is Chablis. Chablis.
Okay.
Chablis.
Nice. All right, we just found out your first job. What was your first cocktail love? What, like?
My first favorite cocktail love was one of those old fashions with the orange and the cherry muddled in and the extra sugar.
That was second wave old fashioned. that is the old fashioned I learned as a bartender how to make, which I'm glad is no longer, but yeah.
What do you consider the most overrated virtue?
Patience. Patience is for poor people.
Dude, this is on the Proust questionnaire.
Patience is for poor people. Done. Next.
Oh, jeez.
Yep.
Holy cow.
I said it.
Karaoke song.
Whitney Houston, I Will Always Love You, and I have no musical talent, but I will always sing it.
I like that dancing song for Whitney Houston. I can't remember which one.
Let's dance. The last dance.
Okay, well, since we're talking about jobs, choose one. Blooming onion or giant turkey leg?
Cheese fries.
Well, that's offensive. It's not a turkey leg. It's a chicken leg. What?
Okay.
Yeah, well, obviously.
It's some kind of protein.
Blooming onion. But really cheese fries, because that's the best thing that Outback has ever made. And I still go to Outback on my birthday. On my actual birthday, January 27th, I celebrate 7 days of my birthday. It's called Felicia Navidad.
How nice.
And on the 7th day, we go to Outback. She rested.
What's the best item at medieval times?
The 44-ounce cocktails.
44 ounces.
Treat yourself.
Holy shit. I have one more follow-up question for that. Did you have a Renaissance name or a medieval name?
No, but I would oftentimes speak in a Southern accent. Welcome to medieval times, y'all.
What's like one weird fact that nobody would know unless you worked at medieval times about medieval times?
Oh, jeez. We're just breaking apart medieval times, guys.
I need to know more.
Girls that hook up with knights at medieval times are called knight riders.
Holy fuck. Kit, where are you?
I wish this episode would go on forever.
I know. I wish we had known this at the forefront of it. It would have been a totally different episode.
Oh, God.
Best job I ever had.
Thank you so much for joining us.
It was a pleasure. Anytime. Better late than never, Eddie Kim.
What? I bring you cake.
He'd bring you cake.
He's only bought me cake 3 times in my whole life.
That's three more times.
A lot of other people.
Yeah.
That's real love.
Myself included. Listeners, you can revisit this week's episode or previous episodes on iTunes or wherever you grab your podcasts, including the Spotify. And find us on all the social medias as @ShiftDrinkDC.
Don't forget to throw us a review on iTunes or give us a 1-star review on Yelp. A special thank you to Jeffrey Lemereau for our intro music and DJ RegTech for the hilarious sound effects. This is the last episode of the season once again, but please come back. We're kicking it back up again in January. The studio is going to take a little bit of break, and hopefully, well, we'll see what happens in the next year when it comes to administrations. Yeah.
Happy holidays to all of you. Thanks for tuning in.
Thank you, Felicia.
I'm here. Follow me on Instagram at Cuvée Queen.
Cuvée Queen.
And if you have no plans yet for your New Year's Eve, I am guest chefing over at Emily's along with a bunch of talented people. There might be a slider involved.
We're sabering bottles on the roof if people want to come
at
here.
At Rake's Progress, yes. Sabering bottles.
So you have options. And
I'm cat sitting.
Meow.
So all you cats out there.
All you cool
maybe
cats.
I'll document it. So if you're bored, then you can
check me on Instagram.
At left right click.
All right, friends. Until next time, happy holidays.